Welcome to The Great Humbling. I'm Dugald Hine, co-founder of the Dog Mountain Project and A School Called Home. In the spring of 2020, I began recording these conversations with the poet and recovering sustainability consultant, Ed Gillespie. We call them The Great Humbling because this feels like a time of being humbled, brought down to earth and, if we're lucky, back into connection with land and soil and with each other. Thank you for listening.
All right, welcome. Welcome to episode 7. It's Shrove Tuesday as we're recording this. Ed, have you cooked any pancakes yet?
Not quite yet. It's about 9:40 in the morning for me, so there will be pancakes later. You've got to celebrate Fat Tuesday, haven't you? Mardi Gras in the appropriate fashion. But I was funny, I was reading into the etymology, you know, as is my wont, for shrove, which is derived from the word shrive, which actually means to administer the sacrament of confession, to absolve. So I think it's quite appropriate for what we're going to dig into later, which is perhaps founders' confessions, to administer the sacrament of confession from the perspective of founders. And, you know, it's also relevant because obviously Fat Tuesday, Shrove Tuesday is beginning, or the precursor to Lent, where we're all supposed to be getting into our rituals of prayer and fasting and almsgiving. And, you know, if they're not about humility, what are they about?
Well, do you know what? If you dig further down into the etymology, what you'll find is that it comes from a word that means to write. So I know this because in modern Swedish, skriva is the verb to write. And so it starts out meaning to write down a judgment, like to pronounce a judgment, but a judgment gets written down. And then in the Christian context, you get this addition of, you know, the forgiveness, or the penance, but also forgiveness on the far side of the confession. So that's how it ends up. That's how it ends up referring to the sacrament. But do you know what do you know, Ed? I'm going to test your knowledge of Scandinavia. Do you know what people eat in Sweden on Shrove Tuesday?
Oh, God. What do they eat on Shrove Tuesday? Well, it's not going to be the usual fika, is it? So it's going to have to be something special. I don't know. I mean, I want to say some form of exquisitely weird pickled fish, but go on, enlighten me.
Good guess. No, it's something called a semla. And if you've ever had one of these, you'll remember it as I describe it, because what it is, it's a kind of cardamom bun, not especially sweet, just like a bread bun with cardamom in. But then you hollow out the middle and mash it up together with marzipan. I was searching for the English word for it. And so then you put that back in as a filling, and then you put whipped cream, or you know, your vegan replacement for whipped cream of your liking, and then you put the lid that you took off in order to carve out the middle of the bun on the top. So it's like a cream sandwich, a cream and marzipan sandwich.
Sounds really light.
Well, it's suitably greasy for Greasy Tuesday.
That's definitely putting the gras into Mardi.
So I went to Denmark last week.
Yeah, you've been chaotic, haven't you?
I have been. I was back at the Chaos Pilot School, which is a place that has it's very close to my heart. And there was a period of about 7 years where I used to go and teach there at least a couple of times a year. And then for 7 years, it's like a fairy tale, this, isn't it? For 7 years, I didn't go there at all. And then I got invited back. And it was lovely to be back there. It's a weird cross between an art school and a business school. And, you know, at its best, a place where there's a lot of room for both mind and heart and for the learning and practicing agency. And when I was in my 20s, I met some students from there who really inspired me and sort of gave me a kick up the ass as well to step into being someone who makes things happen, I guess. So actually, there's a kind of through line from here into this conversation about what it means to be a founder that we've been wanting to have. But yeah, so I went over the bridge and did a few public talks while I was in Denmark as well. So it was a sort of mini tour. And I realized that if you want to warm up a Danish audience, you can tell them stories about Sweden, because the Danes and the Swedes kind of like laughing at each other. So I actually did the only talk in a year, because it was while I was there on Friday. It was my bookiversary. It must be a better word than that, but it was 1 year since publication day for At Work in the Ruins.
Wow! Congratulations.
Thank you. I did a talk the night before, and I said to the audience, you know, there's one thing in the book that almost no one has even asked about. Actually, Rupert Reed did in our event in Norwich, but certainly I don't get invited to talk about the whole section of the book that's about the pandemic. And so I did that, and it felt really appropriate, actually, because the place in the book where I start writing about that starts with describing this moment of going over the bridge from Sweden to Denmark in the autumn of 2020, half a year into the pandemic. And as the train is going over the bridge, everyone gets their masks out and puts them on. And some of us were taking sort of selfies of ourselves with masks on, because, you know, you had one set of rules in one country and one in another. So, but the Danes told me a couple of stories to bring back to the Swedes as well, including that there's been an outbreak of kidnapping bin men in Denmark this winter.
And why would you want to kidnap a bin man?
Good question, Ed. Well, it seems that the Danes are not very used to snow, because from my point of view, they live down south and the winters are pretty mild most years. This year, they've been getting a lot of snow. The roads have been very slippy, and apparently the bin lorries have not been up to the task. And so people's bins have been sort of backing up and getting overflowing. People have been getting irate about this. And so when the bin lorries finally managed to get out, apparently somewhere near Aarhus, someone was so cross that they kidnapped a bin man or a bin person and held them hostage for the same number of minutes as the number of weeks that their bin hadn't been emptied. Which doesn't sound like a very drawn out hostage situation. But anyway, that's how things are in Denmark. Apparently they've started kidnapping bin men.
Well, that sounds like incredibly reasonable hostage terms and conditions. It's like, you know, if you haven't had your bin emptied for 3 weeks, I'm going to hold you for three whole minutes. But I'm making my point. I'm making my point very assertively. You've been engaging with the chaos then. I gave a talk along with my fellow Futurenaut to the UK Garden Centre Association, continuing my theme of the most glamorous gigs in public speaking. But it was quite interesting, actually, because, you know, when you think about gardens and going, and this is, you know, in a humbling sense of going back to ground, actually, UK private gardens are about 1.8 million acres of land, which if you add them all together, makes, you know, the private garden owner the second biggest block of land ownership in the UK. It's bigger than the monarchy, and it's bigger than the military. It's only slightly smaller than the collective holdings of all the big environmental NGOs, like the Royal Society of Protection of Birds and National Trust, etc. So it's a big chunk. And actually, if you can inspire people to garden differently, then it's quite possible to actually lock a lot more carbon into the soil, you know, by being more aligned and doing no dig and biochar and all various other different types of techniques. But if you do that, then you could make a huge difference to the way that carbon is potentially absorbed and locked into the soil from the atmosphere. So it was quite an exciting sort of session to actually talk to the people who are like the gatekeepers of the UK gardeners to all of the stuff that they do and that they buy. And, you know, they're changing all of the composting now away from peat. And we're now going into a world where we need to be composting all the food waste as well, because only about 6% of UK food waste is composted. And if it's not composted at home aerobically, then it gets composted anaerobically in landfill, which is a massive source of methane. So it was a fascinating event. You know, when you, on one level, you get this gig and then you dig into the kind of context in which you're operating, you go, oh, actually, there's some really interesting, powerful stuff here if we were to get it right. But it did make me laugh, for having been banging on about John Higgs and his writings over the last few episodes, because you'll never guess what the name of the chairman of the UK Gardener Centre Association is.
Is it John Higgs?
No, it's not John Higgs, though. It's William Blake. It was William Blake. So having been talking about William Blake endlessly for the last couple of episodes, you know, when he stood up on stage and introduced himself, I was just having a quiet little giggle to myself at the back of the room.
You see the universe in a handful of hummus.
Well, it was, and it was really about the grounding, because, you know, I just finished John Higgs's William Blake versus the World literally last night. And it's wonderful, the sort of concluding part of the book, which sort of plays a little bit to your kind of at work in the ruins and, you know, working on what's next. And what Higgs sort of concludes is that, you know, Blake was so involved in the sort of binary polarity of his age, you know, at the start of the age of so-called enlightenment, you know, where it was materialism versus spirituality and very much, you know, the world embracing what Blake called Newton's sleep. And Blake going off on the kind of the divine human imagination. And what Higgs sort of concludes at the end of the book, which I really loved, was the fact that it's not about those two extremes, obviously, but the tensions between them in the middle is where all of the, you know, the rich creative thinking genuinely comes from. You know, and Blake was very much of his time, and Higgs sort of argues that actually he was so far ahead of his time, and perhaps it will only be even further in the future. Here we are 250 years on from when Blake was working and creating, but actually we still haven't quite got to the world that Blake might have imagined we could get to.
Well, it's interesting that you say that you associated the later part of that book with the at work in the ruins territory, because it's one of the books that I came back with from the tour. It was given to me by my friend of this podcast, Chris TT, who I did a gig in Brighton with sort of the next to last night of the UK tour, and came back to his place and sat up drinking whiskey and talking about the universe. And he had a copy of it lying around, and I started looking at it, and he said, look, take it, because I think he knows John Higgs. And so he'd been given a copy of it, and he said, you have it and take it with you. And I read about a third of it on my way back, and you've inspired me that I must dig that out and finish it now. But also, your talk about the Garden Centre Association, it makes me think we should really try and get another friend of this podcast, Chris Smage. We should try and get him there to speak to them next year about a small farm future, because, yes, it's about, you know, the kind of the emissions impacts of doing composting differently and the way that we use gardens, but it's also about the food growing. If you look at, you know, one of the bits that I keep coming back to in Chris's first book, A Small Farm Future, is where he does this kind of, based on some pretty conservative assumptions, with a significantly increased population due to climate migration, could the UK be feeding itself in 2050? And he gives a hopeful answer to that question, and the role played by, you know, that huge area, as you say, of domestic gardens is a significant part of that. And so I think it would be really interesting to try and join up the conversations that he's been bringing together through his books and through his blog with the kind of professional world of the people through whom people buy the things that go into their gardens. It's making me think of somebody else who lives down the road from us here, who I'm trying to arrange to meet up with, a guy called Gunnar Rundgren, who wrote a book, I think it's called Garden Planet, which is sort of in the same vein as Small Farm Future. So, yeah, you've sparked a whole set of connections there for me that wouldn't immediately have been there when you said you were going to go and talk to the Garden Centre Association.
Well, I mean, I should say, in credit to Chris's inspiration, I mean, the third element I did obviously talk about was food cultivation. I mentioned the carbon and composting as those bits were connected, but yeah, we were obviously talking about urban gardens and back to incredible edible Todmorden and this huge potential also just of real urban growing spaces as well. You know, there's, I think, I don't know if it was Chris's work, but there was certainly a Guardian piece I read where up to 40% of UK's fruit and vegetables could come from urban green space alone, you know. right. Let alone talking about the wider rural areas. But yes, I will connect. I will connect Chris Mage with William Blake.
Excellent. I think that's a marriage made in heaven and heaven and hell, as yes. Blake would say. No. Listen, I had a message from a listener picking up on our last episode that really got me thinking, and it was Leanne Hunt, who wrote to me and said she found the discussion quite challenging when we were talking about, you know, Neto Liao's the high agreements and the low agreements. Mm. And she said this. She said it's one thing to say that social limits are the way to go, but quite another to implement them, even at the local level. And that rang true to me. And then at the same time, after we'd put out that episode, I was actually, I should have said this at the beginning, we've moved the podcast to Substack. We've joined so many of our friends and collaborators on there. So The Great Humbling is now there on Substack. And in the process of sort of writing up the show notes as a post there, I thought of a connection that I hadn't made in the episode itself, because I did talk about, you know, Peter Lindbergh at Less Foolish and, you know, seeing that example of unscreening that he was writing about, where he and his wife at a certain point each evening, like 6:30 each evening, they have a little ceremony where they put their phones into this beautiful box they've made and put it away. And the rest of the day, there's no screens. Mm. And what I realized, so I sort of saw that there was a connection between what Neto is talking about in these kind of communities, particularly the one he studied in Brazil, making deliberate choices about which technologies they will and won't allow to come into their communities based on what they've observed of how other communities have been affected. But for those of us who are starting a long way downstream of that in terms of how our lives are kind of penetrated and infested by all of these technologies with their gifts and their poisons, well, I think that there's sort of, you know, Peter's example was sort of inspiring me. But then I realized that there's a sort of larger, almost a movement growing around this. And two people who've been doing a lot to bring this together are Ruth Gaskowski and her husband, Pekko, who have a Substack called The School of the Unconformed. And they've made this invitation to their community of readers and anyone who wants to join them to undertake a digital fast in Lent this year. And they put up some really helpful practical instructions for sort of making good decisions about how you're going to do that. And they link to some very sound stuff about, you know, how it's not just about if you just do your changes in your relationship to technology by sort of intensive dieting. So just going, right, I've been doing this, switch off my phone on a Friday night, don't switch it on again till Sunday morning. Well, fine. But you find yourself kind of binging to catch up when you switch back on, if you haven't also actually found some structure, some agreements with the people you live with and the people that you deal with over technologies. And if you haven't also gone into maybe some sort of Shrove Tuesday style, a honest reflection on what you're not proud of in your relationship to and the ways that you use these technologies. So I have been, I've been doing some of that in preparation for joining in this digital fast in Lent. And that meant, amongst other things, cancelling the subscriptions to the two streaming services that we had ended up subscribing to. And in order to do that, I had to finish a project that I've had ongoing since last year. And it's a project which I blame on Tyson Juncker-Porter. It was him who told me I had to do it. last night, I watched the final episodes of the final season of Game of Thrones. So now, years after everyone else, I've watched it from beginning to end. Yes, what to say about that? I don't know. I sort of binged on the war against the Army of the Dead, and then the destruction of King's Landing. And apparently everyone was horrified by that. Apparently everyone was horrified by the idea that someone who's on a mission to make the world a better place might end up, bombing the village to save the village, but having you know, been guided for years by Illich's to hell with good intentions. Well, it was Tyson, you see. He said, I think I'm the only person who's happy with how Game of Thrones ended, because it ends with a a crippled boy who's a descendant of the First People sitting on the throne. That sounds all right to me. Now I've watched it, and I've just spoiled it for anyone who hasn't. But frankly, I think, like, we were the last people to leave Skype. I'm the last person to make the journey through whatever it is. John Lanchester said, if you watch Game of Thrones, you've spent enough, and he said this having done it, you've spent about half the amount of total time it would take you to learn Spanish fluently.
Oh, God.
But we make our choices and we live with the consequences.
That's a sobering thought, isn't it? I was like, well, do you want to have the full, brutal, violent saga of Game of Thrones, or...
do you want to be able to speak Spanish?
Yeah.
Ed, listen, we should get into this this subject matter that we... because we were having a conversation off the air a few weeks ago where we found ourselves comparing notes on some of our experiences and realizing that one of the things we have in common is we have both been alleged to be founders or co-founders of things. And in your way, I think to sort of lay the ground for this discussion, you have been... thinking about where the language of founding comes from. So do you want to lay it on us?
Yeah, of course. So, well, we go back to the Latin, fundere, which means to found. But obviously that comes from the root, which is fundus, which literally means bottom or base, which is why when we talk about the fundament, it's usually in reference to the buttocks or the anus. So, you know, in the very essence of the word, it's about pointing back downwards towards...
Are you saying that to be a founder is to be a bit of an ass?
Yes, completely. I think you have to be a bit of weird, a bit odd, and a bit of an ass. I mean, but I think it, by necessity, even if you go at this, I think, with a notion of humility... there is still something about an element of ego, which is like, I've got an idea which is really important and I need to go out and share it and do it and get others to come work with me on it. And so, you know, there's always that element. And in some organisations that becomes very front and centre. In other places it can be managed in a much more humble way, but I do think it's always there, creeping below the surface.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of heroization of founders in contemporary culture. I feel like it kind of, just as a vocabulary, it sort of obviously it's older than this, but it sort of got valorized by Silicon Valley and sort of spilled out from that. And certainly, you know, in 2006 when I worked my last ever shift in a radio newsroom and was going off to you know, be co-founder of an internet startup, that felt pretty cool. Felt like something that you know, to be able to tell people at parties that you're a co-founder of an internet startup, you don't necessarily tell them what that means is that you're sleeping on one of your other co-founders' sofas because you're all broke. But I also, over the years, I was co-founder of School of Everything. I was the founder of Spacemakers. I was co-founder of Dark Mountain. And now I occasionally get referred to as co-founder of a school called Home. So it's definitely been part of my identity. And like a lot of things that sound cool when you tell people what you do at parties, I think there can be a gap between the sort of the perception of what it implies and my understanding anyway of what it implies. Because... well, to me, to be the founder has always been to be the one who's ultimately left taking responsibility, the one who can't say, well, you know, I've done my hours today. Good luck. I'm off home. The one who is a nightmare to live with to their family because they drop everything to go and try and patch things up. Or like in the early days of Spacemakers, there was Julia Shallett and I who... kind of took it from this meetup group that I'd started to actually doing the first project at Brixton Village. And we got you know, offered a fee by the owners of the market for doing this work. And we set off into it and we said, all right, well, we split that 50-50 between the two of us, because at the beginning it was two of us who were running it. And then as it became clear that we needed to bring other people into the team, I was the one who reduced my fee and used part of that to pay other people to step into it. And, you know, that was the difference between my relationship to it and Julia's relationship to it, was that I was the one who was the founder of the organization. I was the one who was taking the cost when that was what was needed in order to make it possible. And that kind of clarified things for us, actually. That made it easy for us to see that, yeah, like, we were working alongside each other. There was no hierarchy between us. But in terms of the larger picture of what Spacemakers was, I was the founder because I was the one who was holding this sort of larger vision and care for finding a way to make this work that included, you know, being the last person to get paid.
Yeah, I totally connect with that idea of the sacrifice and the risk. And I think it's particularly odd, isn't it, where you're expected to carry all of that responsibility and ultimate accountability, especially when it's an organization which isn't always, you know, commercially oriented. Because if you were in a sort of Silicon Valley startup, then people say, oh, that's fine. Of course, the founder takes all the risk. But, you know, there's often the kind of the potential dangled carrot of, you know, massive reward in repayment for that. But I think in the type of organizations that you and I worked in, it wasn't that. It was sort of like sacrifice. The reward was definitely non-financial a lot of the time. And I remember, I mean, I took a year with no salary at one point, because that was what was needed to be done. You know, other people carried on getting paid. But, you know, you took your founder role and you shouldered that and you did what needed to be done. But I wanted to ask you, what you've, as you say, you just listed the kind of four different entities that you found and co-founded. What was the difference for you between being a co-founder and a founder? Because I've only ever been a co-founder. I've never gone solo. I've never done it on my own. I've always done it with somebody else crazy and foolish enough to work with me.
Well, I think that there's a risk that the language of co-founding is a kind of mystification, a kind of way of avoiding what's really going on in a situation. So I remember when I was going around with Paul Miller and Mary Harrington to meetings with potential investors in School of Everything, we had a 15-minute meeting with this guy whose name I'm going to forget, but he was like a friend of Tony Blair. And he was the chairman of BP at one stage or something. And he was, you get the picture, he was a big shot. One of these people who's busy enough that their meetings are scheduled in 15-minute slots. And the main advice that I remember him giving us in this meeting was, he said, you need to be able to say who's really, you know, the chief executive, who's really the founder of this. Because at the moment you've got this story about how there's five of you and your friends and you've co-founded it together. But you're probably storing up a lot of pain for yourselves further down the line by not being more honest about what the nature of the relationships between you is. And Charlie Davies, who had been kind of midwife to the School of Everything, he was almost the sixth co-founder, but he just never showed up.
Yeah, the startup doula. Charlie Davies, the startup doula.
There we go. We'll tell Charlie he needs to rebrand, but I think he could probably see that there was a lot of pain being stored up further down the line. But Charlie worked a lot with a guy called Peter Koenig, who originated this concept of the source as in a spring rather than source as in ketchup, although maybe both. The idea with the source is that, I mean, people who are really kind of devoted to this lens for looking at things will go, there's never really co-founders. There's always one person who's the source. And the way that you can tell is that they asked for help. So somebody has an idea to do something. They can't do it on their own, which is the only reason why you ever need to create an organization. And so they asked somebody else for help. That, you know, that feels very true to me if I look back at the beginnings of Dark Mountain. I mean, Paul and I went out into the world as the co-founders of Dark Mountain. And that honored a certain part of the truth of what it was like, of, you know, this thing would never have made its way into the world if it hadn't been for the collaboration between the two of us. But it was also, you know, quite open in the story from the beginning that what happened was Paul wrote something where he said, I'm quitting journalism. And then at the end he said, but I have this idea for this strange publication that I'd like to start. And if it's going to happen, I'm going to need to find, you know, people of goodwill who can see something in what I'm seeing and want to work together to make it happen. So he was asking for help. And I think there were two people who responded to that, one of whom was me, 3 months after he'd put out that original post. And we began talking. And out of that conversation, Dark Mountain came into the world. And I think that in our early years, we had some difficulty with how to be true to, like, the two sides of that. Both how much of both our hearts and ourselves had been put into it, but also the asymmetry that there had been a time when Dark Mountain existed only as a dream in Paul. And for me, there'd always been at least one other person involved from as soon as I got involved in it. And at the same time, Charlie introduced me to this, the work around the source. And that was very helpful to me when I was leaving the UK in 2012. And I'd been running Spacemakers for 3 years, founded it. We'd done the Brixton Village project. We were, you know, in the later stages of the West Norwood Feast project, where we created the community-owned and run street market. We'd been doing various other bits of work. And it was a real question. I was leaving the UK. What was going to happen to this? And there were various meetings and various people who were interested in taking it forward. And then Matt Weston, who I knew through Charlie, was kind of working as an advisor, really, at that stage. But he sat in a meeting with somebody else who wanted to, you know, take over Spacemakers. We came out of the meeting and Matt said, I didn't feel right about that, but how would you feel about me having a go at running it? And I said, I would be delighted, because I, you know, I have so much respect for Matt. He's got gifts that are so kind of different to, but complementary to mine. And there was no one in whose hands I would feel safer handing over this thing that I'd created. And then because we were both good friends with Charlie and were kind of seeped in this source work, with a bit of help from Charlie over a slow sort of 2 year period, we handed it over so that it really became the case that Spacemakers became the vehicle for something that Matt is the source of, rather than it still being kind of my baby, but him running it. And that was one of the happiest experiences of my working life, really, was kind of getting to the point where it genuinely didn't need me anymore. That helped when it came to Paul having left Dark Mountain as the sort of, as one of the co-founders, but also the person who'd originally been the source of it. And I think he'd been, you know, in all honesty, ready to leave for a while, but hadn't known how to give himself permission to leave. And then a bunch of stuff happened very quickly. And he wrote to the rest of us and said, look, guys, I've realized that I need out and I don't want to leave you in the lurch. But I'd like to be able to let go of my responsibilities sooner than later. And it only took us a few months, because honestly, like, a lot of the work of Dark Mountain and the life of it had already moved into other hands by that stage. But it meant that I then had the next 2 or 3 years before I left, where I was clearly the source of the thing that Dark Mountain had become by that stage in its life. And then again, I was able to work with Charlotte and hand over to her. And I remember Charlie having a conversation with me about a year before I left. And Charlotte and I were trying to work through some of the kind of niggly stuff. And I was realizing that I'd been getting on her nerves with the way I was doing some things. And Charlie said to me, have you had the conversation with her where you tell her that she's the one who knows what Dark Mountain needs now, and your role is to help her? Because when the source, like that, in a sense, that conversation is part of the transfer of the source from one person to another. Like, the source is the person who knows what's needed and can ask for help. And he was like, if you're getting on her nerves, it's probably because you're no longer the person who knows what it needs. She's the person who knows what it needs. So you need to ask her what she needs help with, rather than assume that you still know. And so that's, you know, those have been some of the journeys of the navigation of it for me. But I mean, I'm really curious, because we've talked a little bit in earlier episodes about your kind of journey with Futera and the kind of sadness of how it ended. But I'm really curious to hear more of, like, if you look back to the beginning of it, maybe through these lenses that I've been talking about, how does it feel to you now to look back on the experience of founding or co-founding something?
I wanted to ask you as well in regard to A School Called Home, which obviously you and your good wife co-founded together. And I'm interested to, you know, to get your take on where the source was there, because the source at the start of Futera didn't feel like either one of us asking the other one for help. It was very much a joint venture. Although interestingly, for the first year or so of Futera, there were three of us, which plays to your point about the School of Everything. You know, when there were five, we worked with another woman called Rebecca Gilbertson, who we'd met through Forum for the Future. And she was actually went to the National Film and Television School and became quite a successful film producer. She went off to do something quite different. So, yeah, I'm interested in that kind of that tension. What I do remember is like having no clue about what we were doing and that being okay. I think in our good friend Sam Conniff's, you know, work around uncertainty, I feel like I've been very comfortable with uncertainty for a very long time. I think the early days of Futera was like, you know, we were passion driven and we were very committed and we had this sort of sense of urgency and energy, and obviously youth, when you start something in your late 20s, you know, you don't mind sleeping on sofas and staying up half the night and working all hours at God sends and partying hard. And all of that was very much part of that sort of startup vibe. And I think it was Joseph Campbell who said, you know, if the path before you is clear, you're probably on someone else's path. And I think, you know, that spirit of sort of can do innovation, optimism was very much sort of driving a lot of those early years. And I remember like younger colleagues, like a few years in saying, oh, this project's really hard. You know, we've never done this before. And I'd sort of look at them and say, well, how do you think we built this organization? We've spent our whole time doing things that no one's really done before, or no one's done in quite this way, and that we've certainly never done before. But that's part of the sort of the magic. And I think you have to get that balance right, though, because I think over time, I started to feel that some of that sort of gung-ho aspect was a bit of chutzpah, that you'd actually find yourself not sort of directly lying to a client, but certainly being deceitful.
Telling future truths,
which is a very polite way of saying it. But, you know, you'd end up in a situation where the client would say to you, can you do this? And you go, yeah, we've done that before. You know, and you get out of the meeting and go, how the are we going to do that? You know, we've never done that before. But you do it, and I hate to say it, and this is one of the reasons, you know, where it became uncomfortable for me, but you do it because you have a commercial imperative and you've built an organization with lots of mouths to feed. And that's where all the values get compromised. I bumped into an ex-employee of Futera at an event the other week who'd been an employee long after I'd been there. And he said, he goes, when I first arrived, he goes, I had totally drunk the Kool-Aid. And he didn't last very long, because I think in the balance of the source, you know, now there is an imbalance. I mean, it's a very successful organization. I'm not going to critique it, but it's not the organization that I co-founded. You know, it's a very different one. And, you know, I look back and, you know, to the innocence of, or the relative innocence of 2001, you know, we founded it in early 2001. It was pre 9/11. I remember, you know, the internet in those days was all dark forest. It was like, in terms of your metaphor, you know, I remember people getting incredibly excited about a webcam on a pot of coffee on someone's coffee machine. And, you know, there was a what we'd now call a meme going around, but there was a bloke who'd got into trouble for locking his bike on a fence. And so he'd set up a website where every day he would take votes on locking something different to the fence just to piss off the landlord whose railings it was outside his property. But, you know, that stuff feels so sort of cutesy and arcane now, but that's where that's where the seeds of Futera were planted, you know, in that era. And obviously we're nearly a quarter of a century on from that now. So it's a very long time ago.
I mean, there's definitely something about an almost kind of organic movement from different phases in the life of something. Or, you know, I once went to Aston Business School in Birmingham and gave a lecture that totally baffled nearly everyone in the lecture theatre about how you can apply esoteric thinking from like the Kabbalistic tree of life and the sort of the Vedic chakra model. And you take the Rogers diffusion of innovation curve and rotate it 90 degrees and put it alongside the two. And you can see that you're just dealing with a much cruder modern version of an esoteric model for how things make their journey from, you know, if you like, from sort of Yeats's In Dreams Begins Responsibility. You're on a journey that starts at the level of dreams and ends up at the level of responsibilities. It's a bit like the journey of a marriage, actually. You start off, you know, in some kind of romantic context of falling in love. And, you know, years later, you're in a life that you've made together that involves, you know, getting kid to school and paying bills and the rest of it. And, you know, if you're lucky and you make a good job of it, there can be a truth in that material, concrete, everyday version that rings true to what you glimpsed in that kind of dreamlike early version of it. But you have to be kind of going through different phases and letting go of earlier ways of being this thing that you are together. And that's definitely, you know, if I look at the journey of Dark Mountain, it had multiple kind of stages of needing to move on from one phase to another. And in the sort of middle years of my time there, early to middle years, definitely the sense in which I was being true to being a, you know, a founder or a kind of keeper of the source was that I wasn't the person who was working the most hours a month on it, but I was the person who was kind of the catcher in the rye, where, you know, two or three times a year, there would be a situation in which the whole thing could have just gone off a cliff and ended. And you sort of drop everything you were meant to be doing that week or that month and throw yourself into teaching yourself how to do something that you never wanted to learn how to do in order to save it, because no one's going to come along and magically save it for you. And to me, that's the thing I was talking about at the beginning of like what it's the sort of responsibility that is the truth of being a founder or a holder of the source of something. But equally, by the latter part of the 10 years that I was involved with Dark Mountain, I was translating that into the work of making it into something that didn't nearly go off a cliff every 2 or 3 months, so that it could be handed on to the next generation of people running it without them having to, you know, live as crazy as I was living during the earlier period of it. And that's part of the growing up of an organization, I think.
Yeah.
But also that work is invisible, because no one sees the accidents that didn't happen because you caught it before it went off the cliff. And it's only that you can kind of point to it and go, well, look, how many kind of small nonprofit kind of literary journals, which in a sense is what Dark Mountain is, are still going 10 years on, let alone still going another 5 years later in the hands of a different team to the team that started it, and still full of life, you know, and still have lots of energy in them. And that's the testament, not just to what I did, but to the way in which we were able to work together as a team to navigate those kind of early and middle years, I would say.
And that's quite beautiful, actually. I mean, you know, organizations, as you say, need to have that source passed on. It needs to become like defined and owned and embodied by, you know, whoever takes the reins and takes control or decides to steer the ship in their own inimitable fashion. And that continuity is interesting, especially as the context invariably changes around you. I mean, like when we first came up with the name Futera, you know, it was supposed to be obviously a kind of portmanteau of future Earth, Futera, you know, in that sort of Spanish sense, which we could have been learning if we hadn't been watching Game of Thrones. We actually were very lucky to work with quite a famous designer, Derek Birdsall, who I think designed the kind of the Penguin book covers, and also the Common Worship Services and Prayers for the Church of England book, which has obviously been in many people's hands. But he was very keen on I remember this is pre 9/11, but he was very keen on the sort of the terror having a sort of slightly terroristic element to it. You know, this goes to show the sort of naivety of the times. You know, Futera was supposed to be a little bit naughty, a little bit insurgent, a little bit irreverent. And that, I think, is very much, you know, the personal embodiment of what I wanted to do, you know, which is what I've continued into my, you know, insultancy. It was the trickster. It was the mischief. It was, you know, the sort of low-key type of element, the playfulness. That was very much me. And that's what I baked into the organization as my contribution. And also, like you were saying, the invisible work. It for me, it was about organizational culture, the stuff that isn't valued on the spreadsheet, the stuff that is hard to ascribe a commercial number to, but is absolutely integral to what makes a happy, thriving bunch of folk. You know, and for me, that was actually, you know, very much what you tried to do with A School Called Home. You know, it was like eating together. It was the very fundamentals of potluck lunches and cooking dinners. You know, our office for many years in central London was in an old townhouse, and we had two fully equipped kitchens in it. You know, and as a co-founder, I would cook for the whole company. I would think, because that for me was such an important part of not just working together, but being together and building the relationships within an organisation, which made it robust and resilient and a safe place full of trust and challenge and mutual respect. And I think when Futera grew, those growing pains were where some part of my heart became a little bit bruised, because once you get above 20 people, it's not quite Dunbar's number, you know, the kind of the 150 people you can have a meaningful cognitive relationship with. But certainly in an organization, beyond about 20 people, it's very hard to have a good personal connection with everyone, because it just isn't the time in every day to be able to go round and listen to folk and have those important conversations, to check in on how people are and how they're feeling about their work and all of those kind of things that you do when you are in that nurturing mode, when you're trying to look after people and keep everyone happy and keep the ship on course. And I just felt, you know, when Futera got bigger than that, it's always when cracks appeared and things went on, or people got upset or felt marginalized, or the work became more dilute and less focused on what we were supposed to be doing in terms of mission. It was all of those kind of things. And I think when it comes to endings, you know, you've had a lot more success, I think, in passing that baton on into, you know, a warmly receptive hand that has then gone on to carry on the pace, carry on the journey. Whereas, you know, I know I've talked about it before, but, you know, I felt like the baton was literally wrenched from my grasp. And so what I was left with was a sense of bereavement and a huge loss of my own identity, because you become associated with that, and you will be always associated with it, whether you like it or not. That's the thing. When you do a decade, or I did nearly two decades at Futera, there's a lifetime of association with that. Even if I let go and I'm totally detached and disconnected, it's still something that people go back to. And I think it's how you also then get the sense of acceptance that whatever the thing becomes is okay, you know, even if it's not something you particularly recognize, because you've gifted that responsibility on. That's not your job anymore. It's not your role, and it's not your accountability. And you know, I'm not quite in a sera kind of mode, but, you know, let them go and do their thing.
Yeah, you have to let it be what it is now. I mean, I think I was very lucky, because School of Everything did predictably kind of crash and burn relatively quickly. So my first attempt at co-founding something with friends in my 20s, you know, cost me one of the most important friendships of that era of my life, because, you know, Mary Harrington and I went into that as very close friends. And it was probably one of those kind of intense youthful friendships that would have had to change anyway by the time we were heading into our 30s. But it definitely, you know, it cost me And it cost, you know, all of us in different ways who were involved in it a lot. So I got to start again. And this is what, one of the things I said to the Dark Mountain team when I left was, if there are things that you've seen me do that you feel like I'm really good at doing, most of them I started off really bad at doing. And you've just benefited from the mistakes that I made earlier. And that, and in a way, like creating A School Called Home was very deliberate. You know, something that Anna and I were creating in our 40s that is kind of a vehicle for multiple things, some of which she is the source of and some of which I am the source of, which can be woven together. Maybe this is a good place to kind of to bring things into land, actually, because I think that, you know, in, when you're in your 20s, it's quite hard to embark on something in a humble way. Like, we called it the school of everything. That sort of, it's not a very humble claim, frankly, is it, Ed? That's even before we get to the story, which we'll have to take another time of, at the time I told everyone I was starting a university. But there's a question here, which is it possible to find a humbler way of taking initiative, of starting things, of being responsible things, of being in a role of leadership? I don't know. Have you got anything on that as we sort of bring this into land, Ed? Any thoughts on like what humble leadership does or doesn't look like?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think for a start, it's self-reinforcing. I think what I learned through the experience was that humility breeds humility. You know, as I said, as a co-founder, you set the tone. So if you can be humble, then you set the tone organizationally for humility. And I think we've talked about it a lot, but it is about being in service to something and in service to something bigger than yourself.
Yeah.
I think it's very empowering when you embody and embrace that type of leadership. It is crucially, in the sense of our podcast and your on around your bookiversary, as you say, is a terrible word, but it's about that grounded realism, not just a kind of a hopeful, perhaps slightly ungrounded optimism. And it's really about that point that you just made about, you know, making mistakes, owning them, learning together, listening, and then sharing the credit, you know, when it's successful. I think so much of our leadership tends to try and take all the rewards. It's very much a sort of trickle-up leadership that you see celebrated around a lot of the time. You know, finally, it's about not having all the answers, you know, it's that uncertainty. And I think that's what makes for very human organizations, which, you know, at the end of the day are just built on trust, respect, and collaboration. And there's some old saw that everyone says, isn't there, which is like, humility is not thinking less of yourself or even thinking yourself less. It's thinking of yourself less. And I think in terms of leadership, that is exactly what we need much, much more of.
Well, so here's a story that I came across a couple of days ago that feels like it might be a good place to close this conversation. It's from a book. It's a book by Rowan Williams called Silence and Honey Cakes, The Wisdom of the Desert. So it's about the desert fathers and mothers and, you know, these people who in the 4th and 5th century were basically, well, I mean, they were the founders of Christian monasticism, if you like. They were inventing a completely new and very demanding way of life together in the desert, in Egypt. And anyway, there's this one particular story that struck me as a glimpse of what humble leadership really looks like. And it's about a character called Macarius the Great. There we go. Great and humble. So in this particular story, he's been told about this self-confident monk whose counsel has been depressing others. And the elderly Macarius pays him a visit. And this is the story as it's recorded in the sayings of the Desert Fathers. When he was alone with him, Macarius asked, "How are things going with you?" Theopemptus, the self-confident monk, Theopemptus replied, "Thanks to your prayers, all is well." The old man asked, "Do you not have to battle with your fantasies?" And he answered, "No, up to now, all is well." He was afraid to admit anything. But the old man said to him, "I've lived for many years as an ascetic and everyone sings my praises, but despite my age, I still have trouble with sexual fantasies." The Apemptus said, "Well, it is the same with me, to tell the truth." And the old man went on admitting one by one all the other fantasies that caused him to struggle, until he had brought the Apemptus to admit all of them himself. And then this is Rowan Williams commenting on the story. He says, "You know, what you notice here is self-satisfaction is dealt with not by confrontation or condemnation, but by the quiet personal exposure of failure in such a way as to prompt the same truthfulness in someone else. How tempting it would be to go in and say, 'I know you suffer these temptations.' Macarius refuses this easy way and goes instead by the way of what they talk about in these texts as death to the neighbour, a refusal to judge, and instead exposing himself to judgment. But there's just something in that which for me is modelling what humble leadership might look like, that we, by admitting our own struggles, doubts and failings, we give permission to other people to be real. And in that way, we become less trapped by the things that we've been struggling with, but, you know, too embarrassed to admit or whatever it is. So as I go into, you know, trying to cut back on a lot of the ways in which I am not terribly proud of how the technologies weave into my life and demand my attention and take me away from just being able to be following the work that's mine to do and being there for the people who matter most to me, I'm gonna take the example of Macarius, and hopefully we can all be paying that forward a little bit in owning up to the things we struggle with ourselves in ways that leave others feeling less alone and less trapped by the things that they're struggling with. And I feel like maybe that's part of how we create the kind of living culture that I hear you speak of in what you were attending to within your work at Futera, and that's at the heart of how Anna and I talk about the work that we're trying to do with A School Called Home as well.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We're grateful for all the messages we get from listeners and the other ways you support us, sharing these episodes, spreading the word, and rating them on iTunes and elsewhere. To explore further along the paths we walk in these conversations, subscribe to my Substack, Writing Home, and check out the online series at A School Called Home. You can also find us on Facebook as The Great Humbling, and Ed is at FruCool on the platform formerly known as Twitter. The Great Humbling is produced by David Benjamin Blower, and the title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions.